I'm Brandon Bartnick, and this is the Future of Mobility Podcast.
The Future of Mobility Podcast is focused on the pursuit of safe, sustainable, effective, and accessible transportation of goods and people. Given the critical nature of the world's climate and energy needs, these topics have never been more important, and they're certainly important to me. So, this podcast is a weekly interview series in which I learn from and put the spotlight on the people helping to develop and implement the technology required to move us forward. Who am I? As mentioned, my name is Brandon Bartnick, and I'm an engineer who realized that making a positive impact is the most important thing to me, both through this podcast and my career in the industry. If you're passionate about any of the topics I cover here, please feel free to reach out on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to connect. Also, if you hear anything you like, please consider sharing the Future Mobility with a friend or colleague. This podcast is brought to you by Edison Manufacturing and Engineering. Technology innovation is great, but it doesn't mean anything if we can't bring our impactful products to life, which means we have to build them. And unfortunately, that's easier said than done, especially for startups and evolving companies that need a reliable option for low-volume builds. That's where we come in. Edison is your turnkey manufacturing partner, specializing in build and assembly of highly complex products in annual volumes of 10 to tens of thousands, utilizing an agile and capital-light approach. If you need a trusted manufacturing partner, then please visit us at edison-mfg.com or feel free to reach out to me directly at brandon.bartnick@edison-mfg.com or by visiting my LinkedIn page, Brandon Bartnick. Now to this week's episode. Today's guest is Tim Papandreou. Tim works to bridge the gap between bleeding edge innovations, their real world application, and their impact on the way we live, work, learn, play, heal, and do business. He advises many startups and is keynote speaker and workshop facilitator on several emerging technology spaces, including generative and predictive AI, supply chain automation, robotics, teleoperations, smart cities, ag tech, bioplanning, blockchain, digital twins, space economy, and Web3. He does this in part through an advisory firm, ETA, that he founded to help startups, governments, and corporations accelerate emerging technology innovation. So that's what Tim is doing today. He's done really cool work in the past as well, including holding positions for Elfit and Google X's Moonshot Factory. He's now a key advisor on AI Moonshots, with Waymo, where he's part of the commercialization team that launched the world's first automated robotaxi truck system, and as chief innovation officer for transport with the city of San Francisco, leading various first-of-its-kind policies and projects. So Tim knows what he's doing in this space. I love the way he thinks about, I mean, he has the experience of what goes into making transportation better. I also love the way he thinks about this and kind of the first principles approach he takes. We covered a lot of grounds here. We end up talking kind of conceptually about, okay, what is mobility? What's the purpose of mobility? And how does that then definition and understanding shape the way that we should be thinking about improving the way we're moving around within cities and in other settings? We talked about where we should be focusing our effort to make improvements, the importance of system thinking, and the importance of not just being myopic in the way that we're trying to solve these problems, and a lot more. And a really fun discussion, one that I walked away with lots of thoughts afterwards, and kind of my head was spinning after this one. So I hope you enjoy. There's a lot in here. Please enjoy this conversation with Tim Papandreou. Today I'm joined by Tim Papandreou. Tim, thanks for joining the podcast.
Great to be here, Brandon. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to the conversation here. I think you have a unique background and perspective that I'm looking forward to digging into and getting your thoughts on some of the big questions in the mobility space. So if you wouldn't mind kind of to start with the elevator pitch, or kind of the high level, what do you do and what have you done in this mobility space?
Yeah, so my background is pretty broad, but I come from the world of transportation via urban and regional economics and urban planning. I like systems, and I've really enjoyed how everything fits together. I actually got into architecture school at the very beginning of my academic teachings, and I found that they were so obsessed with the building that they didn't really know or care about what got in and out of the building, and I cared about everything that was getting in and from the building. So I remember having a lot of arguments and conversations thinking, this is like not really what I'm into. So I was like, this is what I like to do. I used to draw cities. I used to draw networks. I drew transport lines, freeways, highways, airports as a little kid. This was that kind of kid that I was. So my parents were like, we don't know what this kid is, but this looks like architecture. You should go and do architecture. And when I went there and I showed, and this is what I like to do, they're like, oh, that's regional and urban planning. I'm like, oh, what's that? So then I sat in a few classes and then was like, oh my God, these are my people. So it's lots of systems, lots of layers. It's like very multi-dimensional, which is what keeps me interested in things. And so I've worked in government. I've worked with consultancy firms. I've worked with engineering firms. I've worked with startups. I worked at Google, Google X. I helped launch the company Waymo, which was the world's first autonomous vehicle technology company. I was the first chief innovation officer at City of San Francisco. We launched a lot of the mayoral initiatives. We did the first strategic plan for a transport authority, which resulted in actually us moving the mode share of the city from 62% car down to 50% by car and sustainable modes 3 years early. So I just saw the power of, you don't have to be the director or the CIO or the CEO of anything. You can actually just work with people and do cross-functional teams and just hire, make sure you find a few champions and you can get some really amazing things done. So I've been doing that ever since. I left Google X and Google when we launched Waymo in Phoenix. I have now my own advisory firm called ETA Advisors, and we work mainly with governments, corporations, startups, and investors to really understand and navigate the world of emerging technologies. So mobility is one of the areas. I work primarily in mobility, energy, infrastructure, and then in this smart cities type space. So they're really the four main threads. But as you know, mobility cuts across through all of them. I always joke that it's the skewer stick in your kebab that you're eating. It's the transport cuts across everything. So it's always part of or something related to what I'm working on.
So I guess I've recently now heard the skewer stick in the kebab, and the other analogy I was given was the blood in your body of like the thing that moves. And this is a question that I've spent an embarrassingly long time trying to get to an answer to, and I have something that I kind of believe in, but would appreciate your perspective. So what's the point of mobility? What's the objective? Yeah. And what are we doing here?
So here is the what it's not about, right? Oh, it's not about just that. Everyone thinks it's just getting from A to B. The point is to move people or things from A to B, and we're done. Others say, well, it's to move people from A to B in the most efficient, effective, and sustainable ways. Not everybody agrees with that, right? Other people say it's the most important way to get around, to be seen because of status, and I want to be seen in my bling bling SUV, whatever, right? Others say high speed rail is the only. So it's always like a mode. This is the premier mode. This is what mobility is all about. Others say you should walk. Here's what I've learned over my two decades of doing this. The point of mobility and transportation is to connect people to the most important moments in their life, whether that is people as friends and family, whether that is work, whether that is learning, healing, having their lives saved. That's the point of mobility. We're supposed to basically connect people and their things to the most important moments of their lives. And I think that's the most important fundamental thing.
And I want to go deeper there, but quick. So I guess the tagline I've settled on this podcast, which I've been unsettled here for a while, and I think it combines a couple of things you mentioned. So like what I say is it's safe, sustainable, effective, accessible movement of goods and people. But yeah, that feels incomplete to me, but I haven't found anything better. And the closest to what you've explained that I've heard is Larry Burns, who maybe you ran into at Waymo in the time, right? And he gave the opinion of, well, no, it's access. What you're trying to do is give people access to the things that allow them to live a fulfilling life. And so you can replace like the most safest, more sustainable, most effective way to get the for us to talk, right, isn't me getting in a plane or getting in a vehicle that's electric and then getting on a plane. It's this, right? We're not close to each other right now, but we're having a meaningful conversation. And like this is somehow tied into this idea of mobility, even though it feels so different. So how, given the definition or how you're thinking about getting people at accessing, connecting them to the most meaningful moments in their life, like why is that so different? How does that fundamentally change the way we should be thinking about then the solutions that we put in place?
Yeah, so I think that's a really, really important question. So it's like we're looking at it, if we're looking at mobility as the glue that basically allows us to have those communications and those information exchanges, we need to make sure that we're doing it in a way that's very seamless and that actually works. So think of it this way. Think of if infrastructure is the user interface to how humans experience the physical world around them as one big concept, that user interface is multiple systems that if they work together really well, it becomes truly a seamless experience, right? So if we have transport, communications, water, waste, all the other pieces that make our world, our physical world, that's really the fundamentals that we need to be focusing on. Mobility is just one piece of that, but mobility needs all of those other pieces to actually work. Otherwise, we have friction, we have barriers, we can't get to the outcomes that we want to get to. And then we have these memorable but not positive experiences. People say, I hate getting stuck in traffic, or it's so expensive to get around, I can't physically access these things, or the way that the city is designed, I can't, you know, access my jobs, education, etc. So all those things basically are almost like the fundamentals, and that the mobility is basically literally the experience. So how good that does, and you've seen cities around the world, right? Where you've gone to certain cities and they're just so easy to get around. And you've been to other places where it's either one mode or forget it, right? And so the more modes you have to experience that infrastructure, that user interface, the more it feels like you're part of something. And the less modes you have and the less ways you have to get around, the more you feel excluded and you kind of feel like isolated, right? You're not really experiencing the city because your cognitive map becomes super narrow and super linear. And it's really just, I got on here, I get off there, I go there. Whereas if you are in a city where you can literally walk everywhere or bicycle everywhere or even take really good public transport everywhere, you have a much bigger cognitive map of the city and you have a much more finite fidelity of all the layers of in a city because you're going at the pace that you want to go to. You're not going at the pace that you're being forced to go to. And when you're going fast and you're going fast and small in a controlled environment, you don't see much, you don't experience much. So if you can go at a speed that is comfortable to you for your senses, like in walking or bicycling or being around on a train, et cetera, even on a bus, that is actually comfortable and it's actually stimulating, then you see the world in a different way and you connect in a different way.
Yeah, and you're touching on another thing that I've struggled to make sense of in my own life. So my wife and I have done some traveling to different cities, and Amsterdam's at the top of my list, I think, of place that I want to go and spend more time with. And when people ask me, and it's not the coffee shops, it's not in any of the things that are illegal in other places that you can do there, but I have such a hard time explaining why people should go to Amsterdam. But like the experience, right? It's, I don't know, I was in a place, it was an Airbnb experience that was nice, but then also it was, biking, walking everywhere. Like, I've had a hard time, other than like, oh, it's cool to be able to bike places, but I have such a hard time talking to people who haven't experienced that and being like, no, for some reason that experience was better to me than going to, like London or like these big cities where it's so much harder to get around. And I've had a hard time putting my finger on it.
Yeah. So, one of the fundamentals that people ask about is like, why do they like certain cities more than others? Why are there certain places that just resonate, that just feel like more of the place we can feel? And it's because it's a symphony of the senses, right? All of the senses in your body have been stimulated in a positive way. There's clearly examples where you have been in places that you just find viscerally, you just don't like them because of all of the noises, etc., whatever it is. But there's, for some people, for example, like you just said, Verna, why it is that Amsterdam feels like the place for you to get around is because Amsterdam has slowed everything down. Really hard to go fast in Amsterdam. They've made all the streets as calm as possible so that you are the priority in the city and that everything else, even the cars, are guests, right? They're treated as guests, but you are the front stage show. And for you, walking along the canals, riding your bicycle everywhere, even taking their trams. It's a very different experience than you hopping in a car and being stuck in traffic in Atlanta, right? It's a whole different experience. Not that there's anything wrong with Atlanta, but that's just a very diametrically different experience. And so if we can find more of those places around the world that bring us that kind of sensory enjoyment, we can quantify that and design that in other places. And we've seen it happen many, many times. So the question is, why don't we have that in the places that we live? And what's the reason behind that? So for me, I always like to, it's so easy when I'm talking with people, they can say, well, I don't like this, I don't like that. And my response was like, well, why is it that way? You know, don't just not like something, find out the background of it. What made it to this point? What rules, policies, and laws got in the way along the way to get us to this point where, in your words, it's unlivable, right? So, and then what's needed to go back to make it livable? And that's classic, you know, urban experiences.
Yeah, and how do you? So this is getting on another one of the things that I've struggled with. It so like the that makes sense on the surface, right? It's also can be abstract and it can be daunting. Like that this conversation, right? When we, it's easy to say, hey, I have a car parked outside. Let's make it electric. Let's remove the tailpipe emissions, and I feel good about what I did. Or I have this vehicle. Wouldn't it be cool if it never got in accidents? And if there wasn't a driver in it, let's make it autonomous. And it's a very difficult engineering task, and there's lots of work to be done. But you have a linear progression. Whereas when you zoom out and you have these more systems level problems that you're trying to solve with a bunch of different actors who are coming together, it quickly becomes daunting and complex and difficult to figure out, like, well, what is the right thing to focus on, and how do I know if I'm actually making progress? What do you do about that?
I mean, you're asking the systems thinking approach. You know, it's like what you just the, you, your first examples were that's very linear thinking. If we do this, we get that. This is the input. This is the output that we get. We need to think more in systems, right? So these systems are basically interconnected. They touch at certain junctions. They touch at certain points of time, but they're not all synchronous. They basically have their different moves based on what their outcomes are. So a systems level, a linear thing would be like, okay, we have cars, we've got a problem, it's congestion, et cetera. Let's just make the cars either greener or cleaner, or well, that's all we can do, or have them driven themselves, and let's hope that there's less congestion. The systems level approach is, look, cars are fundamentally the wrong form factor for this urban experience. But what's the car give us? The car gives us mobility, it gives us freedom, it gives us on-demand transport, and it lets us basically experience things on our time, right? So this individual mobility desire, this individual private mobility desire is the fundamental piece of that. So it's like, okay, that's great. What can give you that in an urban experience that basically matches all those things? It's basically a small, really small car. Some people call it a bicycle, other people call it something else. But the form factor needs to basically be the same footprint as a human, and the individual private mobility will give you those experiences, those outcomes that you want. Now you've done a systems level approach, because what that means now is that if we have a footprint that is basically a tenth of what a car is, we free up more space for all the things that people care about, affordable housing, for parks, for gardens, for whatever it is, right? It also makes the city more compact. Now we can actually, our concept of time and space is bent back into a more manageable experience. And then we also have, because it's been such a reduction in form factor and a reduction of footprint, we don't have as much emission, waste, and noise and everything else. And that means that we can have a much more pre-car urban experience than like a post-car urban experience. And this is where I think a lot of people get stuck. It's like, cars are bad, we need to ban them, traffic noise, et cetera, da, 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 versus there's really good value that cars give us, but it's just too much. We have too much of a thing around us. It's physically too big. It's physically too much space. And it's only that big because we've spread ourselves out. We want to go far. We've got, because we spread ourselves out, we have to go fast. Otherwise, we're going to be wasting our entire day. And to go fast, we need to be basically armored with this material around us. Otherwise, if we crash, we die, right? So this is the thinking that goes behind that. And every single step of the way, we've made a decision that made logical, rational sense at the time. But the cumulative effect of all those decisions has resulted in this unlivable, unsustainable, just boring places that no one wants to really live in, but we're kind of forced to because what else are you going to do? Oh, and by the way, our taxation system and our mortgage lending system kind of says this is all you can actually do to have family wealth. So all this stuff is basically, is basically feeding itself in a vicious cycle until someone or some entity says, stop. Is there another way we can do this? How do we get the best qualities of this while actually having what we want, which is, ironically, you've probably done it yourself. Families in the US fly thousands of miles to just walk in cities in Europe, right? Just to walk, just to have that $5 gelato and to experience just, serendipity in a public plaza. Why don't we have that back in the US? We have it in certain pockets in certain places, but not like they do there because they were fully built out before we had cars. And they've tried, even though they've tried to retrofit their cities for cars, they haven't been very successful. We went the other way. We went full on. We literally demolished our urban centers to make room for cars. I mean, the European cities were bombed during World War II. We actually did it by policy. We actually bombed our cities by policy to make them way for, not for the enemy, but to bring in the car. So we've had these, I would call them schizophrenic policy outcomes that weren't didn't the outcome wasn't what we expected to get, or it was very different from what we expected. So we have to start from that place of understanding the system, and then from the system figuring out ways we can tackle each of those pieces. But I will tell you this, in my experience, and I've worked on all sides of this camp, I defy anybody to come to me and say, I can make the cars fit. I can have the urban experience. I can create the convivial serendipitous spaces, and it's gonna all work the same. I have yet to see that. It's like once you take the cars out of the equation, the form factor, take the form factor out of the equation, everything else just works. And that's, I defy anybody to tell me any different.
Yeah, no, I'll confirm your point of going to Europe just to walk and sit. Of like I've been to Florence, for example, for a couple of times, and like when family or friends ask me like, yeah, why is that? I mean, of course, yeah, going into Tuscany is nice, and but like I'm not there for, I'm not a super art guy, but like I enjoy sitting, walking, running the streets
Right.
and the feel of the place, right? Like it. And I haven't, I, so I live in the Detroit area. Detroit's done a great job of building up certain aspects of the downtown environment. But I think of myself as like a, I've settled on several solutions that I think are the right solutions for myself. And like I've intentionally come to them, but like they're suboptimal at a system level in that I don't
Of
live in
course.
the city center. I'm in a suburb. I have a small kid, a second one any day coming. I have
Me too.
car. Nice. So we both have the mix of excitement and fear ahead of us, but
Yeah. At least you've done it before. Mine's the first time. So I'm literally like flying blind, but at least you've done it. This is your second time at the rodeo. But
congrats.
yeah. Thank you. Thank you. But I totally hear you. Like, and why do you live in the suburbs? Why do you live in a place like that? Because there's all these extraneous factors that kind of force your hand. You don't, if you could, you would live in a garden terrace apartment with like a huge balcony that they do in Europe, where the balconies are like, 10 feet wide, 10 feet deep, and like, 50 feet wide. And there's a park at the end of the street, the daycare, the food, all the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker, they're all within 2 minutes walk of you. That's a very different opportunity versus what we have here, unfortunately. And Detroit's a great example. Just look at the photos of Detroit aerial maps before World War II, and then look at the aerial maps after World War II. The place was gutted. Like 50% of the urban built form was demolished to make way for freeways, streets, or just straight up, quote unquote, urban renewal. which is, you know, code word for displacing people of certain economic classes and certain races. And so that is really hard to come back from. And yeah, they've done a yeoman's job, and you know, kudos to all the planners who are working on trying to do infill and putting all the missing housing and bringing back all the services and the restaurants and the cafes. It's just really hard compared to what other places in the world already have, because they never did that, you know. So yeah.
So where should, I mean, yeah, building the right way from the ground up is easier. That's not, especially here in the US and North America for the most part, it's not, that's not the luxury we have in a lot of places. If you do want to make things better, like where's the right place to start?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really at the end of the day, we have a housing affordability crisis in the US. And it's not even a crisis. It's a chronic illness, right? It's just something that we know the cause, we know the symptom, and yet we just keep pretending that we just keep taking Benadryl and hoping it goes away. It's like we need to go in and change our lifestyle, right? So number one is we need to change our zoning across the entire country. The zoning has to be much more inclusive. Most cities in the US, more than two-thirds or three-quarters of the zoning is for single-family houses only. I use the word houses on purpose because our government uses single-family homes. Homes create a emotional connection to family, and that's what makes them feel like this is the right group of people to live in a single-family home. Whereas a single-family house is just a detached house. It's a frankly a waste of space. But we've actually commandeered that and made it emotional. So kudos to the government for their marketing on that. So just the language we use is really important. So zoning to allow single family houses to be allowing to have accessory units in the background so that people can age in place, for example, or that young families can move in, or that, you know, for example, let's just say your parents have a house with a fairly good sized backyard if they're in any suburb in the US. But if they could build like an accessory unit in the backyard that was like a two bedroom, one bath, at least one of you siblings with your spouse and your child could live there for at least a couple of years until you save up money to do your own thing, right? We need more of that. It's not building hundreds of high rises. This is not really the solution for the US. The solution for the US is we can double the density of our suburbs just by allowing a unit in the backyard of every yard that makes sense, right? We also have these commercial corridors that have really underutilized retail because they need parking requirements. And if you look at any satellite map of any street in the US that's got commercial, half the land is dedicated for the building and half the land is dedicated for surface parking. If we got rid of that parking requirement and just said, let the designers of the developers in the city figure out what they want, how they want it, like just figure out the way you want to do it. Don't make it a requirement, just make it as a feasibility opportunity. You'll see a lot of creativity there. So all of a sudden, overnight, we've doubled the density without changing any of our urban form, and we've increased the commercial footprint and commercial foot plate without changing the urban form. Two things. That's going to have a ricochet effect on our traffic because people still drive their cars everywhere and get around by car. So we're going to have to price our transport system more effectively. Right now, it doesn't matter how you get around, you don't pay really your fair share. So charging to use the transport system, you always pay to get on the bus, but you don't pay to get on the highway or the road or the freeway. Yes, you pay some taxes in the background, but you're not paying a direct user fee. And so we need to create an equalized transport user fee for every mode of transport and even get to the point where you're paid to walk or paid to ride a bicycle, because your impact on the transport system is actually positive versus negative if you drive yourself in your own car. So they're kind of like the three big overarching systems that we need to really tackle on. And you'll be amazed, once you do those three things, all of a sudden everything else that's more fine grained and high fidelity, like bike share, car share, ride share, whatever the shares, or public transport, or whatever it is, those things become much more viable. Because all of a sudden now we've sent signals to the system saying more people closer together, finite road space. We need to reallocate road space to have dedicated space for walking and bicycling, dedicated space for high capacity movement of people and goods, frankly, not just people, but and goods. And the market will basically figure itself out. We have just spent 8 decades distorting any semblance of economics out of the transport system. And this is what we have. We have an oversubscription of basically a public utility, and we need to bring it back and understand that it's a finite resource and have people pay the fairest amount they can to utilize a space so that everybody can access it rather than no one. That's what we're going to do.
Without getting, because this is such a complex thing, I think it's hard to get too deep, but like I think the tag NIMBY gets thrown of like not in my backyard, right? Of like,
yes.
Generally classification of there's pushback when there's change, right? So like people have made decisions and have gotten used to a certain way of things. So often that is maybe a lack of understanding of how things change or where they at. But at the same time, like I have a hard time painting any specific person, especially generalized people, as like for the most part, people are acting rationally within the worldview that they see in the way that they have assembled things. Yeah. Like how do you deal with that kind of natural pushback when you make changes? So someone thinks, yeah, of course it's free. The road's always been free, but it shouldn't be. But how do you deal with that?
Well, so, you know, this is where we need to be really good storytellers. It's like, you know, people don't realize things until you open their eyes and they see it. Now, they have a choice to close their eyes again and say, I don't care. Or they can say, wow, that's really eye-opening. Now, what do I do with this information? You know, so there's the challenge we have a lot is we have a lot of advocacy and activists who say, you should just do this, should. And yeah, we should. But how? Show me how, right? So we need to show a lot more how. And so that means that we need to do a lot more pilot projects, more demonstration projects. We need to iterate until we get it right. And because we've spent 8 decades getting ourselves to this point, we can't turn around in 8 days or 8 weeks or 8 months or even 8 years and expect to change it all. It's not going to happen because, to your point, a lot of people like the way it is. It benefits a few people, and those few people that it benefits don't want things to change because it means that they're giving up something. But the majority of the population is actually losing on a daily basis. You know yourself, right? The cost of car ownership is going through the roof every year. It's now close to $12,000 a month. The cost of home ownership is unattainable to the majority of the people in the country right now. Healthcare, all these things, education, these are becoming out of reach for a classic, you know, family or even what we used to call middle-class family because of all of these extraneous factors. And the question is, do you want to just have a slow decline where no one's going to be able to afford anything in the future? Or do we want to try some things out that we're not 100% sure about, but my gosh, they're much better than the options we have today. And it's going to require some adjustment, but it's going to require some teamwork. And we're going to have to figure out how to basically iterate on the fly, which means that we need you vested in this to work with us together and give us the feedback so that we can learn. And that means that government, when they do this, better be able to receive negative critical feedback and respond in real time. And we did this when I was in San Francisco. We started changing the streets because everybody came to us saying, too many people are getting killed. It's too hard to get around. My auntie, my grandma, my cousin, whatever, can't drive for a whole bunch of reasons. The transport system's too slow. You know, the transit systems are delayed, etc. So, okay, really important points. To do that, we need to reprioritize our streets. We need to create space for people to walk and cycle. That means we need to create space for people to take public transport. And we'll give you more options and more choices. And they said, that's all good and well, but then you're taking away the parking. So where am I going to park? Well, we're going to have this interim state where things will be a little harder, but then we're going to give you a lot more choices to basically use if you can. And most people could, but some couldn't. And so you're going to have to acknowledge that. Like if your system today, where most people are negatively affected by the system, but some are positively affected, and you change it, you're going to have most people upset, some happy, but hopefully it flips over time. And we've seen that happen, you know, in many places around the world where people are like, I don't want these streets closed. How could you do this? This is ridiculous. I don't want these cafe streets, blah, 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 these plazas, etc. They close them. Everyone basically goes away. A month later, they say, well, the experiment's over. We're going to reopen the streets. No, 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 no. We love these plazas. We love this space. It's amazing. It was my idea. How could you take it away from me? That sort of thing. So all this to say is that we need really good storytelling. We need to get to the why. We need to get to the how. And we need to have ownership, joint ownership. Because if we have the how and the why and the joint ownership, we'll actually get to some really good outcomes. The mistakes that have happened in the past, in my experience, have been government knew everything and just went ahead and did it and didn't tell anybody. Or government basically didn't know enough and spent analysis paralysis over and over and over again. And we didn't get it. We didn't get what we wanted. So that's really the how in my experience, at least, I found is the best way that we can try to do something new, to push against a little bit against the status quo, to go a little contrarian, and then try and see what we can get in that conversation. Because sometimes you have the loudest voices who are not really even participants in this space. They're just there to make noise. And I don't listen to them. I listen to the ones who actually have got a vested interest in the success of this project and are giving me critical, constructive feedback. That I can work with. But if you're just here to basically gatfly me, I'm going to get out my fly swat and swat you. That's just how it is, you know.
Yeah, and I appreciate your thought kind of to push back on this opinion if you think. But like listening to you talk, and I think my role and I think people listening and working in this space, it seems like empathy and perspective shifting is so important here, right? And that if we come across and, like, yes, there are people who maybe there's a lot of people who are pursuing, kind of vehemently pursuing solutions that I don't think are the right solutions, or that they have a misguided view about what's going to change the thing. But, like, I don't think having, you know, the coastal elites versus the middle of the country, or the war against a certain technology, or pitting things, like, I think that fundamentally, once we get into those battles and people are putting their feet in and fighting that battle, like, we miss the point of this whole thing, which
absolutely.
Is, no, you have a perspective, and you probably have a bias. I have a bias. We all have a bias. And let's uncover this and be clear about, like, the system level effect here. And then it seems like that's an important conversation that you can have before you can even really move in the direction we want to move.
That is so important. Like, you know, the need to empathize. So in the design thinking world, where, you know, I did a lot of work there when I was at Google, we're one of the, you know, pioneers of the design thinking movement. And it's like, among others that have basically understood in the physical infrastructure space. And the first thing is, you know, think big, get out of your limitations, right? Think big. Empathize is the immediate step, right? So you have to put yourself in their shoes. And I did that when I was chief innovation officer at San Francisco, where we were going to change the streets. But in order to change the streets, we had to design them in a way that we hadn't had those designs in the city before. Yeah, we'd gone to Amsterdam and Copenhagen and all the cool places around the world, but did they work and translate in San Francisco? So that meant that we got our transit engineers on bicycles riding alongside buses. We had our bus drivers, you know, ride bicycles in next to the bus just to feel like, what does it feel like? We had bicycle engineers actually ride in the bus with the bus driver. They're like, where's the driver's blind spots? Like, what can they and cannot see? We also had our traffic engineers who were, you know, we want to speed things up. They're like, well, there's a lot of traffic light sequencing that has to happen. We need to get you in a wheelchair, or we're going to basically put you on a walking cane and cross that street. What does it feel like to be 80 years old, to be vision impaired, to be mobility impaired? Because you can be this, like, you know, and I had a lot of them, right? These, like, late 20s, like, super fit, you know, mostly guys saying, we should do this, cycling is everything, we should just ride bicycles, etc. And it's like, but not everybody looks like you, not everybody has your fitness level, man. And, like, we got hills in San Francisco, so how do we deal with that? So the empathizing in the design process meant that we could come up with, like, really good ideas that meant two things. We couldn't do a one-size-fits-all, because that's not how it works, but we could make sure there was something for everybody. So for you as a fit cyclist, you got to protect the bike lane. You as a person who prefers to take public transport, a dedicated transit lane so you at least have a reliable service, right? Barrier-free platform. You who can't use either of those two things, we're going to have much stronger relationships with car sharing. So that at least you can have car sharing. And then ride sharing and ride hailing came in. Like, it's about getting those choices so that there is something for everybody, but there's no one-size-fits-all. But you can't even get there without empathizing who you're working and solving problems for, right? And with.
Yeah.
And it's that co-creation part is really valuable, like working together to say, okay, well, here's my idea, is the world's best practice. They're like, yeah, but that's not how it works here in my neighborhood. We work this way. Okay, well, let's work on that. So let's ultimately, it's about, you know, we want to please our constituents and our customers.
Yeah, cool. I appreciate that perspective. And I guess if you don't mind, maybe a little, this related but slightly left turn question. So why?
Yeah.
Why are you playing the role that you're playing in the ecosystem? Why are you personally, right? You've had several of the hats within this ecosystem.
Yeah,
worked
yeah,
on
yeah.
specific technologies. You've played in the on the planning side and city side. Like, why are you doing what you're doing right now?
It's a good question. So I am a person who gets bored very easily. I'm one of those people that when I was a little kid, I read the encyclopedia from A to Z back to front because I was like, you know, this is what I want. I just want to absorb it all. So this is how I roll. But when I got my first job in college, I realized really quickly that there was going to be a lot of these skills that I needed to basically accumulate over time to do what I wanted to do, which was basically a version of it. I didn't know what this was, but it was a version of this where I could basically, you know, I was obsessed with cities. I was obsessed with systems. I love technology. I love people. I love food. I love all these things. So I want to experience the world. I'm like, well, how do I get to experience the world and travel and do all this sort of cool stuff? You can't do it in a, you know, a job that's tied to a certain place. I mean, you can take vacation, but I wanted it to be part of my job. And so I got into consulting. I got into corporate. I got into startups. I got into government, different levels of government. And each one of those roles was basically building up towards this role that I was going to become one day, knew I was become an independent owner of a company. And I was going to basically run a company that basically would help people understand the world in ways that we don't right now. I didn't know it was going to be like this. I thought it was going to be more on the architecture side, but then it became more on the transport and mobility side. And now it's more on the technology side. So it's just evolved. And I think it's just more of like, I have the voice now. I have a platform where I have the background both in policy and in technology. You know, in any Star Trek fans out there, I speak both Federation and Klingon. So that means I can go into most spaces and places and really connect with the people really quickly. I've also been in operations. I've got my hands dirty on every mode of transport there is that I could get my hands on. I've either planned for it, financed it, launched it, operated it, assembled it, dissembled it, damaged it, had to repair it. So like I understand how these things work. Also with urban planning as well, you know, built developments. I've built my own place. I've renovated my own place. I know the planning codes back to front. So if you've lived those experiences and you know those experiences and then you translate it into like the future and technology and being, you know, now that I'm working on like, you know, AI and blockchain and a whole bunch of different technologies in that space, that just gives you that rounded groundedness where you can now say, okay, ultimately we're working with people. If we're working with people, we're working with personalities. If we're working with personalities, it's storytelling, it's empathy, it's connecting. Everything else just serves that basically. So that's my role, is to connect people, bring them together, solve big problems and make things better as best as I can. I can't solve it. I can't do it. And learning, I can't do it myself. I have to, and I want to do with a whole bunch of people together because the many of us together can do amazing things.
Yeah, cool. And I mean, we've talked about systems level thinking of a few different time.
Yep.
What are the best resources or places where you might send someone if they come to you like, yeah, I want to understand how to apply this and how to learn about the foundations here.
Yeah. So it's one of those weird things where, some people, I don't agree with this, but some people say like, you know, you're either born with it or you're not, you know, you're either born a systems thinker or you're not born a systems thinker. I don't think that's true. I think you can learn to become a systems thinker. It's hard. You use your left side and your right side of your brain simultaneously. So that means that you think big and dream while working on the project management and practical numbers part. It's what makes you very effective in systems thinking. I would just start my searches on a little search engine that starts with a G and start looking at, you know, how do I become a systems thinker? There's a lot of YouTube channels on this. There's a lot of books out there. But I would just start there. Just start at the very beginning. The fact that you're curious, that you want to learn more about systems. I find that most people who try and learn about systems thinking realize very quickly, I'm already doing this. I just didn't know it was this, right? So if you have a child, If you have two children, you're a systems thinker. This is how it is. It's like, that's just how it is. If you have teenage kids, you're a systems thinker. So it's basically, you know, anybody who has to do multiple things at the same time, you're a systems thinker. It's not multitasking. That's very different. You know, multitasking is proven to be not be very effective. It's systems thinking is basically understanding the world around you, understanding the key players around you, and understanding the key variables, and just looking and listening for the signals of when they start to basically come up and paying attention to them. You don't have to own and hold them all the time. It's just they'll just pop up, just attend to them, then attend to the next one. It's not whack-a-mole. It's much more strategic. You are stepping back to understand the world around you, and then you're going in a target fashion.
Yeah, I feel like this pod, I mean, and I, as you mentioned, kind of already had realized I was thinking in this way, and I was in process engineering on a manufacturing floor, and before, and but I got into started this podcast 4 years ago, and like the first couple, actually, I had a hunch on Amsterdam. So the first episode is with the Dutch cycling Amsterdam. Like, oh, there was something interesting there, and then I thought I was just going to cover what are the cool technology that are being developed. So electric, and what's the new ICE thing? Let's talk about hydrogen fuel cells. Let's talk about autonomy. And then as I got deeper into it, I realized, well, there's no clear answers here. These things work together. And I'm like, well, actually, technology development fuels public perception, but public perception actually determines as well where money's going to develop technology. Both of these things inform policy, but policy also informs both of those things as well. And there's a system there. And the technology that's developed has to be deployed in some way. And you have to be able to build a bunch of viable commercial structures and businesses around this, or else you're going to develop a business that goes out of... So you have to learn how to identify a value proposition, go and pursue it. You have to learn how to lead and operate a company. Like, none of these things can exist without the others. And so, like, yeah, I think I've naturally... and I struggle with, and that was some of the first questions here of like, the more I think about this, the more complex it is, and the more stuff there is, and it feels comfortable to come back and be like, hey, let's just co-focus on like this little corner, because I know I can make progress in this area. But my goal here isn't like, I'm not a car guy. My goal isn't like, I'm excited about the opportunity to do something better, right? And to somehow move something forward. So like, I haven't been able to convince myself that that's good enough of like, no, just tone in on something that feels right. It has to be pursuing like what actually is the right thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and you're doing it, you know, it's like, you know, I'll reflect back onto you, like, you know, you're achieving one of the most important feats of our life, which is you're having children, right? That's an amazing job. It's like, think of it as your little mini startup. Now you're getting startup number two. So like, you know, you've got that whole huge world ahead of you. You're also interested in this space deeply. You've created a podcast. You're getting as many people on the show as possible to articulate their experiences. You can't help but absorb all of that over time and realize that there's these big fundamental systems in place. And I think that's what I think is very helpful for people who start to listen to this part of their background. They know this, but when they actually get to see and experience it, because it does a few things. It opens up your mind to curiosity. Curiosity is what basically breeds all of our innovations. It's like, you know, well, why is this way? Why is this broken, et cetera, et cetera? How do I make it better? You know, innovation is all about removing barriers to make things better. It's not about inventing brand new things. That's not innovation. That's invention. We confuse them a lot sometimes in technology. And we look at that from a perspective of, okay, if I'm going to innovate and make things better, who am I making them better for? And can I make it better for almost everybody in one shot? Or do I have to iterate over time to include everybody? Because if you make things better for like the 0.1%, that's just a novelty. They're not really helping anybody out, right? So a lot of our technologies in our mobility space are really geared towards the 1% or 2%. They're not really for the everybody. And a lot of the technology that was invented, frankly, over a century and a half ago, like bicycles or the just compact modes of transport in a densifying urban world, that's kind of the answer, you know? And it's like, Okay, you don't like the form? Change the form. You don't like being exposed to the elements? Cover it up. You don't like to pedal and use your human power? Motorize it. Like, this is this thing. It's like, that's how you do systems design level thinking, especially in like the manufacturing process. But we never get to those answers because there's always someone new come and say, no, it's aerial tramways, or it's monorail, or it's hyperloop, it's this, that's whatever. It's like, what are we solving for? And if we can't agree that that's the answer to what we're looking for, then why are we pursuing it? Now, having said that, we also should be very careful that we don't say this is the way and there's no other way. We also should have room to allow more ideas and new ideas to come in, but we should be able to like quickly say, it's not going to really cut it. This is what I loved when I was working at Google X. You know, I was in the innovation lab of Alphabet, and we were at the moonshot factory, and our job was to basically create moonshots, which was, you know, a global problem with a breakthrough technology that can scale and solve and become commercialized. And the last part was the hardest part. Like, can it be commercialized, right? Because you've gone from these two pillars of mega systems thinking to commercialization, which is a very linear output. Does it have profit or loss, right? So that was a really good way of having incredible ideas, but then getting to the reality check and saying, this isn't going to cut it. Like, it was a great idea, shelve it. For some reason, we have these transport ideas that every 5-10 years just keep coming back up. They keep spitting up the pill, as they say. It's like they can't swallow the pill, digest it, and be done, right? So it's just one of those things that I keep, it keeps it humorous for sure, but it's also a distraction, because if the 5,000 cities of the world, which are the cities of the world, if they focused on their zoning, their parking reform, and their street design allocation, and then they had a viable walk, bike, and transit system with ride hailing on top of it, everything else would work. They just need to do the basics. So they're building the basics. And I always do the food analogy, right? A lot of the technology is the icing on the cake, but we need to actually grow the flour and make the cake. And a lot of places are not doing that. They're just jumping straight to the icing. And when you have icing, it just melts. It doesn't do anything, right?
Yeah, and I guess I was going to make a different kind of health analogy that came to mind as you're talking about it. Like, this feels a lot, right? Because I went through a similar thing of trying to figure out, like, okay, how do I keep a healthy body? And like, there's so many different exciting things that you can pursue.
But
lift some weights, do some cardio, get the blood pumping, be active, try not to sit too much, eat whole foods, don't eat too much of it. You're 95% of the way there, right? And then you can go and so like it doesn't need to be the sexy new inventions that are solving it. It's kind of like, get back to improve on things and get back to fundamentals, but do the things that work.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. If you look at fundamentals, like, you know, my other world is health and wellness, right? So yeah, you're exactly right. Like, I have one more for you, right? So it's really good sleep, really good hydrate. So you need really good sleep, consistent sleep, consistent hydration. So electrolytes with no sugar in them. Just, you need electrolytes because you are changing your lifestyle. Lots of physical activity where you're physically lifting heavy weights, so you can actually pull the growth of the muscle. And then you need to have a calorie deficit. You really need to focus on protein over carbs over fats and be in a calorie deficit. If you do those four things, you're going to look amazing. You're going to feel amazing, and you're going to live as long as you need to live. Now, that's one part of it. There's also family, relationships, stress, all those community, etc. A lot of the blue zones, you know, I'm Greek, and so one of the big famous blue zones where people live to 100 is where my dad's from. And everyone's focused on their diet because they say, oh, the diet's the blue zone diet. I'm like, well, that's actually a piece of it. It's the community. It's the physical activity. It's the companionship. That's what keeps them going. The laughter, you know, the constantly moving in their body all day long. You know, those are really the key things that keep that whole holistic approach. It's not just one piece. And unfortunately, in this linear economy of ours, we always want to have that one piece. That's the answer. I'll just do that and I'm done. It's like, no, you know, we need to look at the whole system. Yeah,
I think well said. So, Tim, this has been a blast, and I think I'm sure I'll be listening back to this and thinking on some of these thoughts on these topics for some time here. But really appreciate you taking the time and sharing what you have here today. Anything that we've either missed, or is there anything that you're hoping that someone who listens to this takes away from the conversation?
I think, you know, we didn't touch upon like what's hap how this how AI is going to be affecting all of this. So I would love to like just give a little snippet on that if that's
Yeah, go ahead.
possible. So you know, we've been talking about systems and how these systems basically are all interconnected. Now we're bringing in the world of AI into this, where we're looking at generative AI. We've had a lot of different types of AI in the past, whether it's computer vision, machine learning, fuzzy logic, et cetera, et cetera. That was what we used a lot for Waymo, for like the autonomous vehicle technology itself. Now with generative AI and the work with end-to-end AI, where basically the whole thing is done by itself, that opens up a lot of new doors, opportunities for us in the world of mobility. And so it's not just about managing traffic and managing you know, the prediction of the routing, managing our fleets, et cetera, all these different things. We're starting to see a lot more discussion about how do our systems and processes itself, public policy, transport planning, economics, et cetera, all those things will be impacted by the various forms of AI coming in. And it makes us go, funnily enough, into back to the beginning of the conversation about people, about connecting people to the moments of their lives, and understanding that everything that we've been doing that we like or don't like, AI is going to amplify. So we better get our biases in check. We better get all of our processes in check. We better start understanding these places and the outcomes that we don't want very carefully, because AI will basically optimize for the ultimate reward, which is I want to basically please my prompter. And so if we basically said that this is the outcome that we want, it'll focus and get the what we need. So I think that's just something that I think it's very careful. Like I'm focused on that really deeply right now. And I really would like us to have much more conversations with public agencies, with government authorities, with OEMs, et cetera, on how are we going to integrate the various family of AI, but specifically generative AI, into this fabric, because it's going to fundamentally change how we just look at this.
Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe that's a full another discussion that we have at
Yeah,
some point, because there's
exactly.
a lot to unpack there. But I think, yeah, glad you highlighted that. And yeah, I think that's a good place to leave it. Well, thanks again, Tim. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate the
You're
work you're
so
doing.
welcome. Yeah. Thanks for having me, Brandon. Have a great weekend. Appreciate it. And good luck with your second child.
There you have it. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Tim Papandreou. So what stands out to me? So the first is that the high-level question. I mean, maybe this sounds so abstract that you're getting, I don't know, I'm skeptical of my own thinking at times of as I try to explore this topic. But the discussion about the purpose of mobility and the role it serves in connecting people to moments in their life is really interesting to me. And I think that's something that we have to have in mind as we are making efforts to improve the way we're getting around, is that we're not getting around for the sake of getting around. We're getting around so that we can have access to things and to people and to places and to moments. Super interesting. And the complexity of it also continues to stand out, right? Of you can't solve transportation challenges by only thinking about transportation. He talks about things like affordable housing and zoning and parking minimums and things like that, which I guess I originally had thought when I first got into this space, I originally thought of as like adjacent to transportation, which I guess on the surface level definition it is, but you can't solve one of these problems without the other because this is a complex integrated ecosystem. It's a system, right? And that's what we spent a good chunk thinking about is like these are moving. There are many pieces that all come together here and that actually impact each other. There's not a lot of one-way impacts and communication streams. There's two-way complex interactions within the system, and you can't solve one without also thinking about the others. That makes the problem bigger. It also makes the problem more interesting in from my perspective, and also more meaningful as we make progress towards solving this. So, yeah, like I said, really fun discussion. I love the way Tim thinks about this stuff and communicates, and there's lots to solve, lots of things for us to figure out. But this is really optimistic discussion from my perspective, and I learned a lot. So I hope you did as well. Thank you for listening, as always. And there's more to come next week.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Future of Mobility Podcast.